for all the students I've had, and again, it's total is close to 25 or 30,000 students. Whatever I have given them, and I'm grateful for them saying, you know, we appreciate what, we're grateful for what you've taught us. They've taught me far more. The names you mentioned, I could tell you what Amber taught me, or Judy. I've learned so much, and it's been a tremendous benefit to me just to call these people friends. How many professors have zero students that they call friends?
The bison, 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 the bison.
Professor Emeritus Rick Hilliard taught at Nichols College for nearly 30 years. Anyone who attended Nichols in the 80s, 90s, or 2000s would remember Rick's classes well. Many would say that Professor Hilliard is as much of a fixture on the Nichols campus as any of our buildings even. In fact, if there was a Mount Rushmore of Nichols professors, surely Rick's head would appear on it. Countless students have taken Rick's classes in the undergraduate or graduate programs, including myself. I had Professor Hilliard for the leadership experience in Business Today while earning my MBA from Nichols. Ask any student what they remember about Professor Hilliard, and you'll get a multitude of answers. Corvette driver, high-level executive, business owner, author, mentor, business plan creator, advice giver, and even answers of a more cloak and dagger variety, which we'll get into later. I've heard so many stories over the years about Rick and have seen his former students bring their own kids to tour Nichols and bump into him on campus. Welcome, Rick. It's a pleasure to have you on the Nichols College Alumni Experience.
Well, thank you, Brent. It's a delight for me to be here. We're sitting in one of the rooms in the back of the library looking out over the hillside. It reminds me of just how beautiful Nichols College is as a campus. As far as your introduction, I think you just about said it all, so I think it's time for me to go home.
Well, we do have a lot of ground to cover today. You still own an advisory business. You do lots of work with the church, and you're writing a new book. So I could probably keep you here for hours asking you for questions, but in the interest of your busy schedule, we're going to try and keep this to about 40 minutes. So for our listeners, hang on tight. It's going to be an interesting ride. Let's start off by saying, so Rick, you've been involved at Nichols as an undergraduate professor, graduate school professor, and professor emeritus for 32 years. Before we go backward a little bit and talk about your career as a, or your time as a counterintelligence officer and your career as a high-ranking business executive, let me ask you, so how did you go from the Travelers Insurance boardroom to the Nichols College classroom?
That's a good question. I never had any self-doubt. I always felt confident that I could do what I put my mind to do. I was successful with the Travelers. I became an officer at a very young age. I then had an opportunity to move to the Equitable Life, AXA Equitable. I was a vice president and a senior executive there. I had an opportunity to move to a small company and become the president. I began to realize that there had to be something more. I made a lot of money. Mm-hmm. Even when I arrived on the Nichols campus, people remembered I was driving a Porsche, which I parked illegally out in front of the snack bar.
You can only do that with a Porsche.
Only with a Porsche. I wanted more, and it wasn't money. In my last position particularly, I really reflected on what have I done that I enjoyed. And I had been an adjunct teacher at various places. I was an adjunct at Harvard, Villanova, University of Connecticut, and I could go on, University of Texas. But that brought me great joy. And so I decided to become a college professor. In my search, I was led from one campus to another, taking advice from various people. I find myself at UMass Dartmouth. I was living in Pennsylvania, but I wanted to come back to New England. The dean at UMass Dartmouth said, I like you very much, you're a good person. And I networked my way in there, which I taught thousands of Nichols of students the importance of networking. And he said, Nichols College is going to have an opening in the management department. And then he smiled a little bit and he said, they don't know it yet. But he said, they're having an opening, and he said, I suggest you go to Nichols College. And really, that led to my next 32 years. I took his advice. I came to Nichols. I stayed. I love Nichols.
A lot of the stories that I hear brought up by some of your former students during your days as an undergraduate professor anyways are the rumors that you were a spy. I understand actually you were an officer in the Counterintelligence Corps, which is basically an organization founded by the Army of trained special agents. Could you tell us a little bit about your time in the CIC without having to kill us?
First, I would have to say that the Counterintelligence Corps, since the early part of World War II, and some can take it back to the Civil War, counterintelligence was a group that people, the general public, simply did not know about. I was at Bates College, and one of my roommates, and we were assigned people, had a friend come in for a weekend. The friend was a little older than the rest of us. I was a sophomore, and we were chatting in the wee hours of the morning. And he said, what are you going to do when you graduate? To me, what are you going to do when you graduate? And I said, I'm not sure yet. I thought I'm going to the insurance business. He said, well, you know, you ought to consider the Counterintelligence Corps. And I said, what? And he said, the Counterintelligence Corps. He said, I'm a part of that. He said, if you ever tell anybody what I'm telling you now, I'll have to shoot you. But he said, I think you'd be good for that. And then he went on and he was telling me how he was actually in the military. He had gone to this incredibly wonderful training school in Baltimore, Maryland, Fort Holabird it was called. And he said, I think you'd be good, but he said, you'd have to qualify, you'd have to be admitted. And I said, well, how would I do that? And he said, well, you have to read Time magazine every single week and know all about the world affairs. He said, and you have to realize that 50% of the people flunk out of this intelligence school, and then they were in the infantry sloshing through the mud. So I said, well, that sounds interesting. And so I did. I applied for, in my junior year, I applied for this. I read the magazines and did everything I had been told. They had me come into Boston. It was fascinating. I was down on the waterfront, the original waterfront, and I was to go to a door with like an X marked on it, and like a number 52 or something on the door. So I went, and it's decrepit, and there were holes in the walls, and I knocked on the door. And a little slot opened, you know, who are you? And they said, welcome, come in. And I went in, and there was this thoroughly modern building with a view of the airport from the back and all the, but it was hidden, it was undercover. I was tested, I was asked questions about history, current and past. I was accepted, I graduated from college. I had a summer. And that's when I decided to teach at Harvard, and I did. And I went to basic training and flew through that. And then I went off to the intelligence school, which it was in a railroad yard, which when you think about it, is a pretty good cover. Trains going through. Anyway, I was part of a class. Sure enough, there were 50% of them did flunk out. I failed a critical course. I remember it well. And getting places with using the map and no light and at night. And there were like six of us. And I said, you know, I've been a Boy Scout. I can lead you to where we want to go. And I had the map. I'll never forget. They just followed me. And I said, we came to a road, and there it was on the map. And I said, we turn right. So we turned right, and pretty soon there were all these lights, and we're all walking along. And there was a couple of trainers at the under the lights. And as we walked up, they said, you've all flunked the course. You've all failed the course. And they took us and they put us in a little huddle, the six of us, and they said, now the reason you failed the course is you didn't check. This is an old map, and the old map does not have the new road on it. And I said, oh my God, if I flunk and I go into the military, I've learned a lesson that's going to last me the rest of my life. You have to know how old is the information that I have. So anyway, we were all flunked out. And so I went to the instructor on my own. And I went in and I said, look, I was a Boy Scout. I know how to read maps. I understand. I'm willing to go. But the others have, they're not at fault at all. And I said, I really want to take the bullet for them. And then he was a young guy. He was probably 2 years older than me. And he said, did they argue with you at all? Oh, no, I said, the truth. No, they just did what I said. And he said, did any of them question you? And I said, no, absolutely not. And he said, I want to think about this. And I said, fine. I thanked him. And we had actually a good conversation. Later, I found out that I had been accepted. I was there, and I passed the program. But all four of the others flunked out. And the reason they flunked out, because they didn't question me. They just accepted my authority. I was their age. I looked like them. And they didn't question me. And therefore, they all went off and were gone. And I thought there was another lesson that I'd learned that's going to last me in business for the rest of my life. So anyway, the counterintelligence, I was successful at that. I was a domestic intelligence specialist. Basically, I lived in and served in Japan for a number of months. Then I was transferred to Korea, where I lived for about 12, 14 months. And then the most difficult duty of all, St. Louis, Missouri. And I served there until I finished my required tour. But that was one of the best experiences of my life. And I could spend hours just explaining the lessons I learned from that.
It is funny you mentioned that story. I know a person who served as a Navy SEAL, and he said it was sort of the same thing with their academy. They would go in these groups and they would do these obstacle courses. And one of the things was they would say, you have to break down this door and go through the door and then, you know, go over this and then do that. All the groups went through. And at the end, the instructor said the door wasn't locked. You could have just opened it up. You didn't even check. So it's interesting, the problem solving skills that you do get that way. What types of things did you use training wise for the CIC to benefit you as a business executive? And then I guess I could ask, what types of lessons did you learn during your training, which you may have brought along to your students in the classroom?
Well, I should point out, it wasn't all fun and games. Being in the military, yes, I was. It was after the Korean War, and so, but I was involved in a firefight. I could have been killed. One of my friends was knifed, and he died. There were lessons that I learned that I really can't translate into the classroom. But in another sense, people get so involved in their jobs that when they're fired, for example, or when they're encouraged to leave, it's like being wounded. It's like being have a bullet go through them. And I think one of the things I learned was that you can't take it that way. I've had wonderful experiences in business, wonderful experiences, Nichols. Not always everything was wonderful, but I learned that, you know, you can rise above it. You can rise above it. I think in the military, the things that I learned from my experience, both in the school and in actually in the field, among the most valuable lessons were check the information. How old is it? The other thing that I always used was when you get information, when somebody tells you something, evaluate two things. One, and by the way, we had a system of actually evaluating. We'd get a report of something was going to happen. We would actually put the letter and the number. But let's say letter A means this source of information is absolutely reliable. They've never had bad information. They've always given me good information. And I learned to check that. The second thing was the information itself. Does this information track with anything else that I've heard or that we've heard? Or is it simply out of the blue? And then we would evaluate that. And throughout my life, and here at Nichols particularly, the first thing, where did this come from? Second thing, how likely is this to be true? And I would say, in general, students would sit at the come in and chat with me at having tea or coffee. They often were A1s. Their information was absolutely solid, and I found it interesting that you can't go by, you know, professor says, Dr. So-and-so. You can't always say, well, that one is clearly reliable, and sophomore Jimmy is not, or Janie. You have to go on the basis that the information could be right. And this served me incredibly well in business at Nichols. And it reached a point where I was ready to try something else, and that's when I became a professor. But yeah, a lot of good, valuable information.
So 32 years since the late 80s. Obviously, right now, it's a very different and difficult time in higher education demographically. Colleges really have to grow and innovate while making smart decisions so they can stay ahead of the curve, which is something I think Nichols has done a fantastic job of from my perspective as a former admissions director and now development director. But what are some of the biggest changes that you've seen over the years here at Nichols?
I went to Bates College. I came from a poor family. I was on academic probation after my first year at Bates. I remember well them admitting me conditionally, coming back, rather, the second semester. And I was called in by the dean of students, and he said, why are you in so much trouble? And I said, I don't know. It's like when I was in high school. I have three jobs on campus. I'm very involved with the band. I'm involved with a lot of things, and I was the president of the radio station. And he said, well, how many jobs do you have? And I said, three. And he said, that's too many. How did that happen? And I said, I don't know. There were jobs available, and I took them. And so I worked out a deal with him, and we raised the pay on two of the jobs, and the third one we eliminated. Then he said, I said something, I really don't think I'm cut out for college. I love cars and mechanical things. And he said, do you have any idea of how well you should be doing in college? And I said, no, I have no idea at all. And he said, look at this. You've been working full-time all the way through high. I mean, he showed me my record. And he said, there's no reason you shouldn't be a 4.0 student here. That is really what is different now. When I arrived at Nichols, I was driving truly a Porsche, and I was illegally parked. And I went into the snack bar. That's the first place I went on campus. I had an appointment with the dean here. And I sat down at a table, and there were some kids going by. And I said, hey, could you help me out? I'm wearing a three-piece suit with a tie. And they said, sure. And I said, I'm thinking of coming here as a professor, and I'd like to know, what do you think of the school? They thought of Nichols the way I thought of Bates. It was a wonderful school. And pretty soon I had a table with maybe 15 people, and I'm sitting there in my three-piece suit and my tie, and all these kids are telling me how much they love Nichols and how much they love the professors and how much they were getting out of the school. And the fact that all of their professors were practitioners. And I said, well, what do you think? Should I come here? And, oh, yeah, they voted. Yeah, we want you to come here. And so then I went into the dean, and I had no trouble selling myself to the dean.
Well, you bring up an interesting point. I know as somebody who's been around academia since the 80s, you've seen a lot of different generations of students kind of come and go. And I know that you've done a lot of writing and research on the subject of differences, say, millennials versus Gen X versus Gen Y. Exactly how do you see the college students changing in the current times versus the times you first started teaching here? And what is that going to mean for the future of business and the future of leadership?
And I should point out that, yes, I've done writing. I wrote a thesis about generational differences. But I actually, having taught Nichols Graduate School for the same period of time, I actually taught members of the Silent Generation, and I'm one of the few of them left. Silent Generation, the Baby Boomers, and there were two sets of them. I've taught them. And then, of course, the Generation Y, the Millennials, and the new one, some call it Generation Z. The differences are dramatic, particularly if you go every other generation. The newest generation, the millennials, obviously are, I'm very much a computer geek type of person. I was one of the first people on this campus to teach online classes. And yes, I was a firm advocate of online is great, but have classroom too. have the kids come in during the summer or during a break. But, well, that didn't work because we were having people. I had students who were in Afghanistan, Nickel students. They were all over the world. And I thought that was wonderful. And the new generation is very accepting of this. The idea of hybrid classes, teaching part online and part in the classroom. I think the challenge for us with the brand new, the Z generation, is going to be how are we going to get them to come to the campus at all? I think if we have a challenge, it's to have things going on the campus that will draw them to come and stay here. And I think that's going to be the big challenge with the newest generation.
So I remember from the classes that I had with you in the master's program, you actually got me hooked on the writings of Niccolo Machiavelli.
Yes.
And I'm sure you use that advice, and it was a big help reading those books as a CIC officer and a business executive. But I think one of the fine lines when it came to Machiavelli's writings was, or any of our abilities to apply those principles in a good way. A lot of people attend a business college expecting how they're going to succeed in business, learn how they succeed, learn how to climb the corporate ladder, learn how to make a lot of money. But I remember that ethics are always something that you hammered home as a professor. How these days do you teach students ethics in a time where every time you turn on the news, it seems that ethics are being broken?
Regarding Machiavelli, be suspicious, question what's happening. Cherish your friends, hold them close, but hold your enemies closer. This type of information is of extreme value. It's very difficult. Because while I was, when I entered, forget in the 50s, whenever, when I started teaching, but in more recent years, we the world changed. And almost anything that you do any place, there is somebody recording it. Someone's, the doorbell has your image.
It is an interesting topic because if you look at even a lot of criminal enterprises, John Gotti or El Chapo or what. If these people had taken the skills that they had and put that into running a Fortune 500 company, they would have done just fine in the business.
I have thousands of students, as I said, who are very successful. Probably the most successful student I've had is a teacher and a coach at a small school in New Hampshire who isn't making a lot of money, who isn't turning the world over, but he married with children, and I would put him the most successful. I have students who have gone down to Wall Street. Some of them I'll say, you know, let me know when you make your first $100,000, your first half million. And I have students who have written back and said, yeah, I just hit my first million, and I'm headed now for my second or third. And I have students, and understand, some of them are graduate students who are older. I have students who, if you measure strictly by money, and El Chapo, that certainly is one way to measure him. They're incredibly successful. They're pulling in, you know, multi-millions of dollars each year. And the part that is good for me, makes me feel good, is they're worth every penny of it. Not because they had me as a teacher, but because they had people like me at Nichols College who actually knew what they were talking about, and they've gone out and translated that into multi-million dollar salaries every year.
And it's funny because, you know, in my job now, I meet so many alumni, and they, the ones who mention you, you know, just off the top of my head, the whole idea of this podcast came about by an alumni that I met in Long Island named Will Ward, who was one of your students.
I loved him. Yeah, he was a good guy.
And he literally showed me a picture of him, his wife, and you from graduation that he has above his mantle on the fireplace. And then, you know, I meet Amber Martin on our board of advisors. I meet Judy Kaiser, who was just here bringing her daughter on a tour of Nichols, and she had you. And it's funny because everybody kind of takes away a little something different. And they say, well, here's what Professor Hilliard taught me.
Whatever I have given them, and I'm grateful for them saying, you know, we appreciate what, you know, we're grateful for what you've taught us. They've taught me far more. The names you mentioned, I could tell you what Amber taught me, or Judy. I've learned so much, and it's been a tremendous benefit to me just to call these people friends. How many professors have zero students that they call friends. How many professors, I'm talking not just Nichols, but the world, all they want is to be isolated and to do their research. In a sense, I was doing my research sitting in the snack bar the day one. The Porsche illegally parked in front of the snack bar, and me sitting there with one student, and then five students, and then 10, and then 15. Come on, it just doesn't get any better than that. And so I've learned so much from the students. My joy has been dealing with the students. I'm older now. I'm in the process of writing a book. This isn't the first one. And people say, just relax, get a rocking chair. Well, I own a Nichols rocking chair, and it came in a box. And I was grateful. I received it when I retired. I'm going to open the box and assemble it any day now. But it's been sitting in the box for 10 years.
Well, if it's from IKEA, it might take you 10 years to put it together. So, I guess, Professor Hilliard, thank you for spending time with us today. I know a lot of people whom you've had in class are going to be tuning into this episode because they told me they would. And I'm sure today's episode was just as entertaining as they remembered your classes being. The bonus being today, they don't even have to take note. Thank you for being here, Rick.
Thank you very much. It's been enjoyable.
Welcome to the den. Welcome to the pen. The herd taking the court. We going for a win. We going for a win.